Yeah, so you don't have to be quiet for 2 hours. Okay. Which wouldn't work anyway, looking at some of these faces. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, everyone, for showing up. I've been teaching for 5 hours today. This is not the one thing I wanted to do to sort of tap off my day, but here I am. And I'm also sort of here by accident. This study that Environmental Defense Commission was actually originally supposed to be done by one of my former students, but he, at the last minute, decided he couldn't do it, and so I stepped in to sort of pick this up. This is an interesting problem to me, and it sort of fits with the arc of my research. I've been at Davis for 28 years, and I do research that really has focused a lot on the implications of management changes to the economic health of the fishing sector and conservation of the resource itself. And so that's sort of my general interest in fisheries issues. And I've been working on these things for a long time, and everyone is different, of course. I picked this up. I don't think I have any biases. I'm not anti-big fishermen. I'm not anti-processors. I've worked a little bit for the at-sea processors, which were about as big as you can get. I've helped Pete Halmay down in San Diego try to organize his ideas about a little coastal co-op for his 15 sea urchin divers. And I have a whole range of things going that I think are interesting fisheries projects. So let me just launch into this. The task here was to basically discuss these broad questions. What is stranded capital? Where does this idea come from? In what sense has it been used in different contexts elsewhere? What are the potential effects on processors of IFQs? When are stranded costs likely to be significant? What are the arguments for considering these effects? How should we measure stranded capital, and then what mechanisms might be used to address the impacts if we decide we want to do that? So these are, in some sense, the major questions that Environmental Defense wants me to look at. And as was said in the introduction, I'm going to be doing something that is sort of a general paper on this that'll be something I'll get done probably by the end of June. And this is sort of a first shot at some of my thoughts about these questions. This notion of stranded capital really originates out of deregulation of other industries. In the 1980s, there was a wave of deregulation of trucking and airlines and natural gas production, none of which actually considered the issue of stranded capital. The issue of stranded capital came up in the 1990s when we started talking about electricity deregulation. And electricity has been traditionally regulated by promising utilities a price for their power that guarantees them a fair rate of return on the capital. And what happened in the 1980s is that a lot of utilities invested in things like nuclear and undertook a lot of debt on the promise of being able to pay that off with high prices. And then when the electricity market was deregulated, that those capital assets suddenly were in some sense not able to pay for themselves. And so the utilities basically argued that the investments and contracts that were induced by the old regulations and that suddenly became unprofitable under this new competitive market were stranded, and they asked for some relief. The arguments that have been made in the electrical utility debate are several. One argument that's been made is that there was an implicit regulatory compact between the firms and the regulators. It wasn't written down, but it was understood that that the deal would sort of persist, and utilities basically then said that the failure to ensure a fair rate of return on their capital basically constituted a breach of this implicit contract. Other people argued that if the utilities weren't compensated, that suddenly investors would see utilities as more risky, and it would raise the cost of capital and therefore raise some of the prices of electricity, which would then sort of counter the benefits of electricity deregulation. The other argument that's made, of course, is that this idea of not compensating for stranded capital to utilities is unfair to investors, and it reduces the value of shares, which some people have argued is a takings. The responses in these other sectors to these arguments, first of all, as I said, compensation for stranded capital was not even an issue in trucking and airlines and banking and natural gas deregulation, although we know that, in fact, all of these underwent a lot of restructuring, bankruptcies in some cases, a lot of adjustments. The issue really came up in electricity because of the size of some of these large investments, particularly to cover nuclear power. And there's still debate in the electricity deregulation arena about whether these should be compensated or not. The courts have not supported the notion that failing to compensate these is a breach of a regulatory compact. They have not supported the notion that failure to compensate is a takings. Economists have weighed in on this a little bit in these other sectors, and one argument that economists have said is that all these people who are operating in regulated industries are smart people, and that when they make investments, we would expect them to be anticipating that there would be regulatory changes and build that into their investment decision. So in some sense, they'd be making decisions that captured a premium for what they're investing in to account for the risk that was associated with something happening in the regulatory sector. That is an argument that's made. Compensation, other people say, well, compensation is just an issue of a distributional question that's really not likely to promote or affect future efficiency of other decisions. My take on all this is that when we're contemplating changes in regulations, that it behooves us to get all the information out on the table, and that we need to evaluate all the costs and benefits of a change in regulations, which would include, if important, stranded capital. It's not necessary that the regulatory sector has to adhere to cost-benefit analysis, but it should be part of the sort of process to get the information out. Where has this notion come from in fisheries? Well, it's come to us on the Pacific coast here from Alaska. First appeared in the Alaska Crab Rationalization Program, and everyone knows the backdrop of that, which was the halibut rationalizations in both British Columbia and Alaska. We all know the very dramatic change that occurred in both British Columbia and Alaska to the halibut fishery as it moved from a 3 or 5 day fishery to a year-long fishery, from a frozen fishery to a fresh fishery. And I, in fact, did some analysis of this, of the effects of this on processors and on fishermen in British Columbia when they implemented it. And parenthetically, one of the things the fishermen, the processors told us before that fishery was converted into an ITQ is that they actually didn't make anything on halibut, that in fact they didn't like to handle this huge glut of halibut, and they were doing it just to keep the business of people who were delivering salmon to them. But after the fact, there was some change in the processing. There was an entry of new small handlers of halibut. There was some change in the location of halibut processing, and of course there was a change in the flow of halibut production through lots of different plants because you were moving from 5 day season to a 9 month season. So the argument, though, has been in Alaska that the crab processors needed protection from the same sort of thing that might be happening with crab. And crab, of course, had also short seasons and was in a lot of ways similar to what happened in the halibut fishery. Argument was made that, again, stranded capital would become worthless after regulations were changed. Owners of capital would suffer losses during the transition. And as a result of that, we have this quite intricate scheme in Alaska of processor quotas, of lock-ins, of delivery options to different places, done actually without much attempt to measure stranded capital. It was done to tackle this problem, I think, but no one actually did any analysis of stranded capital before or after. Well, looking at both the halibut fishery and the crab fishery, I think are illustrative because they tell us what preconditions we have to have for there to be stranded capital. The most important one, of course, is you need to anticipate that specifically because of the change in regulations, there'll be a major change in product form. And what has contributed to that, of course, is in the halibut fishery and Alaska fishery was a highly compressed derby fishery, a competitive processing sector. Technological factors, what contributes to the possibility of stranded capital, of course, is you have to have capital. There has to be a situation where the particular product is capital intensive and specialized perhaps to one species or at least to one product or at least in a narrow way to a narrow group of things. So these are the sorts of things that we might expect to be preconditions. Now I want to turn to what we might expect with IFQs implemented in the West Coast groundfish fishery. I want to start with the non-whiting groundfish fishery first. I think it's sensible, actually, to, if we're looking for what is going to happen, to look at what's happened in British Columbia. That's a similar fishery. It's slightly different because there was more vertical integration in that fishery than there is here now. But I think if we're trying to anticipate what's going to happen with IFQs here, we don't have to look too much farther, because that is a very similar fishery. And what has happened, of course, is that there has been elimination of surges that were associated with the same kind of trip limit and short-term limits in that particular fishery that were there before rationalization. More allocation of higher-valued products. This market deepening effect, which is very important. Everyone in the business knows that if you are able to promise your buyers a uniform supply of uniform quality, you actually are going to deepen your market and be able to command higher prices, because restaurants, when they put a piece of fish on the menu, need to know that it's going to be there and that they won't have a supply gap tomorrow after they put it on their menu. Same thing is true about supermarkets. Once they build up people's taste for things, they need to be able to deliver a regular supply. So all this sort of regularizing of the supply turns out to be a very important driver of higher values. British Columbia is still, most of the processing is hand fillet operations. Of course, a lot more landings coordination with harvesters. There's been some consolidation among the larger processors in British Columbia at the same time as there have been a moderate amount of entry of new handlers, people who back their trucks up to the docks and take a delivery down to one particular market and bring it there on a regular basis. Situations where small processors are handling fish and delivering it in developing markets, actually. And this developing markets is important. And when I talked to the halibut processors after the BC system was implemented, they talked about prices falling every week when the supply got up to 100,000 pounds. And they said, you know, after a couple of years, we could get the supply up to 500,000 pounds before supply dropped. And it was because they were basically building new markets in the middle of Canada where people had never eaten halibut before, actually. So this ability to smooth out the process is very important to the people up the chain to develop new markets and develop new values. Whiting, again, I mean, the sort of model that I think we want to look at to anticipate what is probably going to happen after IFQs are implemented, if they are, is a slower pace and longer fishery. Optimize the condition of the fish themselves, more product recovery. When I talked to at sea processor people before they set up the AFA, they said that we could probably get up from 18% recovery to about 23% is what their best guess was. These were Surimi technicians. And within 3 or 4 years, they're up to 32% increase in yield of usable product. That's all increased value from the same amount of fish. Very important effect. And, of course, what's also happened that's quite important as a result of AFA is increased flexibility, so that this fishery has been able to diversify itself and respond to market conditions, so that the capital isn't necessarily tied to just surimi, that in fact can be used for other types of products that are higher valued and that are seeming to be higher valued. Well, that brings us to the question of whether we're likely to see stranded capital in the Pacific Coast groundfish fishery. I think the important thing is that things are different between this fishery now and the way things were in the Alaska halibut and crab fisheries. We've got trip limits that have been imposed and within season regulations that have specifically been designed to avoid the Derby fishery. So we don't have this glut of product that we had in the halibut fishery. We've got a product flow that's spread over a season. There are some surges left in it, but those are the things that are going to be smoothed out. There's delivery agreements and coordination in place. It's not a sort of chaotic fishery. And the West Coast processing plants aren't isolated from markets in the transportation network, as they are in Alaska. Not likely, I think, to be a regulation-induced shift in where the fishing activities take place. Again, fishing, processing, marketing are in close proximity already. Markets have been developed for a diversity of products, and there's a much more concentrated processing sector for groundfish than in the British Columbia case. What about the whiting fishery? Well, there are conditions that are similar to the pre-AFA inshore fishery. There is a race to fish, for certain. However, conditions differ in other ways. The shoreside processing is even more concentrated here than Alaska. Alaska was basically splitting up the shoreside fish about a third, a third, a third. It's more concentrated here. There are other things that are different now is that there's a much more deeper development of other product forms that have resulted in part because of the AFA. So there's a strong market now for fillet products and at the same time as weakening surimi markets. They're different. It's a different product down here than in Alaska because of the enzymes. And processing plants here are not isolated from markets in the transportation network as they are in Alaska. So things are different here than they are in Alaska in both the groundfish and whiting fishery. Now, what arguments are there for compensating stranded processor capital here? Well, the arguments that have been made is that effectively failing to compensate is unfair, that it will cause capital value losses to owners. The arguments that are made against it, against compensating, in some sense the more damaging arguments are that compensation can cause future inefficiencies. Some people will argue in this case, as they have in other deregulation cases, that some capital has already been compensated, that people have invested in that in this industry are not stupid as the people were in airlines, and they in fact have already anticipated deregulation. Another argument that people make is that IFQ compensation is going to give processors market power, much more market power than they have, increased bargaining strength vis-a-vis harvesters, give incumbents advantage over prospective entrants, and beat back the sort of innovation that occurs when you get entry that creates value at the, up the market chain. Another argument is that it may freeze existing patterns of harvesting, marketing, and products in place, which again then would dissipate some of the possibility for generating extra values. And another argument that people are making who are looking ahead is that compensation basically holds up the process elsewhere, that if this has to be argued everywhere, it's going to be argued all the way down the chain, and it's going to happen in other fisheries. Right. Let me talk about how we should be measuring stranded capital costs. This is something that people haven't talked about much. But the first thing that's important, of course, is that you need to distinguish between what you paid for capital and what it's worth. And so the issue is, when a regulation change occurs, how is capital that's been in place revalued? And in particular, when is it revalued in a downward way? And when is that a dramatic number? Important thing here is that the value of capital, used capital, depends on its next best alternative use. This is the way economists think about this. And so let's think about this. Suppose we had a situation where we had a brand new surimi plant that was built somewhere by someone who, in fact, was not aware that regulations were going to change, and the whole plant, it was argued, suddenly became obsolete because of the regulatory change. You couldn't produce surimi anymore. Well, the land and the warehouse space is not stranded capital. That land and warehouse space can be put to some other use without any loss in value to speak of. Storage space usually is off-site, and it's usually not connected to the processing facility. Things like offloading, there may have been offloading and pumps that were built specifically to handle high volume. That's fair game. Chilling tanks for the whiting fishery are relevant potential stranded capital. Flash freezing, possibly. I mean, maybe that you've built fresh flash freezing capacity to handle a glut of product flow that then is going to be smoothed out. And so some of it may be candidates for being stranded, although the issue is whether its use is picked up by other fisheries in the same plant, for example, or by something else. Surimi machine, possible. Important thing to know here and to recognize, of course, is that the next best use for a surimi machine that's made obsolete in a particular place is what you can get for it when you sell it on the used market somewhere else. So a surimi machine is not worth nothing if it, in fact, becomes stranded at a particular place. It's worth whatever you can get for that surimi machine somewhere else. So in the end, you know, when you think about even a very extreme situation where a whole plant is in some sense argued to be stranded, there isn't much left there actually that you can count up as a huge value loss. You can count the difference between what you can get for your Surimi machine and what its depreciated value is. You can talk about some of the pumps and chilling tanks, but the big ticket items like land and warehouse space, you can't count those as stranded. It's important also when we talk about measuring stranded capital to attribute stranded cost to the regulation itself. We have to talk about policy relevant stranded capital. Okay, so if we have a situation, for example, where the whiting fishery has begun to move away from producing surimi because the market for other products is strong, you can't count the cost of that extra surimi equipment as a policy cost. I mean, it's a market cost, and it's occurring as a result of market changes. You really need to look hard for things that are caused specifically by the policy change. And then there are lots of things that involve capital that need apportioning. In other words, there are lots of things that are used for the functions of a plant that are associated with other kinds of fish throughout the season and that would likely to be picked up by other uses. In fact, you can store apples in a freezer if you've got one, and you've got extra space. And so you really need to apportion out some of this capital. Some of it is lumpy. So the real key question here is exactly what kind of capital becomes worthless as a result of regulatory change. All right, now I want to talk just shortly here about mechanisms for compensating stranded capital. So suppose we did come to some conclusion that because of regulatory changes there was some stranded capital. What will we do about it? Well, what's on the table here is granting permanent IFQ allocations to processors. But, of course, there are other methods. Another method, of course, is just to deal with it up front, to say, all right, we're going to compensate you for that capital that has been stranded. There are lots of organizations out there these days that are actually willing to grant loans. There are philanthropic organizations that are willing to grant loans to get the policy process over the hurdle to move on towards something that's more conservation-minded. The obvious thing that's been done in other cases is to get a loan and then pay it back with a landings tax. Something people haven't talked about as a different idea is a loan that then pays back with a transfer tax when people sell their IFQs. The other thing that people talk about is some sort of a lock-in of existing patterns of deliveries so that it softens the blow of a regulatory change, so you might have a sliding rent landings requirement, something of the sort that is introduced in Alaska in some places. Another idea is a fractional set-aside of IFQ, and something I thought of was this idea of choosing some fraction of IFQ and then auctioning it off every year and using those funds to go into the compensation fund if you wanted to do that. Now, and in some sense, we're only limited by our imagination here on different ways that you could, once you decided you wanted to compensate, how you might do that. Now, some important administrative process issues here are the importance of measurement. I mean, if we're going to do this, it really is important to make decisions based on measurement of something concrete and that relates to this problem, to stranded capital. And there needs to be a burden of proof. Somebody's going to come up with a method and somebody's going to come up with estimates that, in fact, are associated with beliefs about stranded capital and that are, in fact, tied to stranded capital value. For example, a new person who just got into the business might be a better candidate for getting stranded capital compensated than somebody who's been in it for a long time. I mean, I've heard the notion that stranded capital payment ought to be associated with the history of processing. That doesn't quite square necessarily with stranded capital. I mean, what is stranded really relates to decisions that relates to capital that has been affected by regulatory changes, and that may differ across different types of processors. This issue of codification of definitions and accounting procedures, there are strict ways, there are ways that accountants would agree on about how to assess stranded capital. And there are procedures that could be used. And of course, if you wanted to do this, you'd want to adopt those and make sure that you're doing them with methods that are professionally satisfactory. setting a threshold is important. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go through a lot of gyrations to compensate stranded capital if the amount is small. I mean, if we've got $5 million, $10 million for the stranded capital, every year that is delayed here in getting the fishery rationalized is another year of conservation problems and also another year of failing to develop the returns that you get when you rationalize and unleash the innovation that occurs after rationalization. Very important in this case is assessing spillovers. I mean, the programs that grant an IFQ allocation will obviously affect the balance of power between harvesters and processors. It will also affect potential incumbents. There's a precedent there. And then the last issue is whether you want to handle this with a sort of a one-time resolution of the problem or whether you want to handle it in a way that affects the entire structure of the system you're looking at. All right, so my second to last slide here is there's not much precedent in other settings for compensating stranded costs. However, I think good policy requires looking at the issue and trying to understand whether there are potential stranded capital losses. My opinion, and this is just my opinion, is the preconditions to generate significant stranded costs now in the Pacific Coast non-whiting fishery are not present. The sorts of things that were there in the halibut and crab fishery aren't there in the groundfish fishery. You might make an argument in the whiting fishery, but I don't think the value of stranded capital is very high. And my opinion is that the burden of proof here should rest with the industry to make some explicit estimate of verifiable stranded capital losses. I don't think it's a good policy to just guess at the numbers and then do something like lock in some permanent impact on the IFQ system. The currently suggested fixes seem to me to be implausibly high. For example, a 25% IFQ allocation of processors suggests a $75 million loss in capital, in stranded capital. That seems totally impossible to me. Now let me talk about where that number came from. My last slide here asks the question, what is the problem here? Because the more I think about stranded capital, the more I wonder whether the issue is stranded capital. Another issue that might be driving the discussion of stranded capital is that really this is after rent capture. Now, there's a significant amount of rent capture that's about there to be developed in both of these fisheries. My estimate for the way you do this, of course, is to take lease values that you see in other similar fisheries for IFQ, and you multiply those by 10 to 12. And that's going to be roughly the asset value that's associated with IFQ holdings for these two fisheries. So what right now we're seeing in British Columbia, lease values of about 25 cents a pound, $3 a pound sale values, that translates with 30,000 metric tons of groundfish into about $200 million worth of asset values. I'd like to have a share of that. Everybody'd like to have a share of that. With whiting, the way I've done these estimates, and that you can argue them any way you want, but I used Alaska prices for the inshore system of about 4 cents lease, about 48 cents sale. I've discounted those a little bit because the product down here is a bit different. It still amounts to about $90 million in asset values. And so one important issue here is the issue really stranded capital, or is it, in fact, a struggle over these potential asset values? The other important issue here in the Pacific Coast is this bargaining power issue, processors versus harvesters. The processing here is highly concentrated. In fact, I don't know of any other industry in the United States where a particular activity is as highly concentrated as this is. When economists talk about high concentration levels in things like agricultural processing or in industrial processes or consumer goods, we talk about situations where, let's say, four companies have 65% of the activity. The concentration level here in the Pacific Coast is way higher than that. And so this bargaining power issue is really quite important. And anything that, in fact, tips the balance more in favor of processors is already beginning with a situation where the processors have already a big advantage. The other issue is reducing competition for incumbents. I mean, all the action in ITQs that have been developed around the world have, this is interesting because as economists, when we first started thinking about ITQs, we thought that what would happen would be that the profitability would be developed by reducing excess capital that emerged as fishing fleets built up for the race to fish. But what has actually happened as ITQs have been developed is that excess profits have been developed in the marketing chain. So the process of kind of consolidating fishing effort has taken a long time, but there's been almost an immediate bump in the processing sector where new products have created new value that have affected revenues rather than costs. And where does that come from? It comes from innovation. I mean, it basically comes from competition between different people in the sector all going out there and trying to drum up new business and creating new markets in different places. And, you know, competition is the American way, basically. I mean, it's what innovation is what drives this country, and innovation actually depends on competition. So that's all I have to say here, and I suspect you might have something to say and some questions to ask me. But that's just the way I see it.